This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When you try to pull out anything in nature, you find that it's hitched to everything else. And that's just as true of political ecology as it is of biological ecology.
As we ring in the new year, we should recognize that 2016 marks the centennial of the National Park Service. Today on Sea Change Radio, we speak with author and environmentalist Jason Mark about the challenges that the national parks face moving forward. Mark is the editor of Sierra Magazine and author of a new book, Satellites in the High Country, which focuses on the state of wilderness in the U.S. We talk about the hidden wild gems that Mark encountered while researching the book and discuss how environmental groups like the Sierra Club are approaching the issue of climate change, which looms over the entire conservation landscape. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jason Mark. He is the editor-in-chief of Sierra Magazine. He was also the editor, formerly, of Earth Island Journal. And his new book is Satellites in the High Country. Jason, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex. It's great to be here.
Your book, Satellites in the High Country, we spoke last time you were on the show about the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service and wilderness and wild. You were researching that book. Maybe you can give us a sneak peek of the finished product.
Sure. So Satellites in the High Country basically is my exploration to investigate, is there anything that's still really, truly wild in the 21st century? And if so, how can we hold on to wildness as something of a touchstone for our relationship with the rest of nature? So you think about it, right? There's 7 billion people on the planet. We've got global climate change and all these other environmental crises. Our constant connectivity, right, through our wondrous phones and things like Google Trek, where you can, you know, virtually hike the Grand Canyon or raft the Colorado River, and things like, you know, Amazon drones. Given all of that, is there anything that's still really, truly wild? And so to answer that question, I went to some of the most rugged and remote places in America, went to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, tracked wolves in the Gila Wilderness of New Mexico, went mountaineering through the Rockies. And what I found, you know, really surprised me, and I think it's, you know, surprises the reader as well.
You're from the Southwest, right?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona.
Why don't you talk about some of the most rugged parts that you discovered in the Southwest while you're researching?
I mean, I have to say, going to the Gila Wilderness, which is America's first legal wilderness, established in 1924 by Aldo Leopold when he was just a rank-and-file forester with the U.S. Forest Service and created 40 years before the passage of the Wilderness Act. The Gila is big, wild, open country. I mean, there's few places like it outside of Alaska. You know, the locals in the Gila, they don't go anywhere really without couple extra gallons of fuel and water in their vehicle, because if you break down, you've got a 40-50 mile hike before you're going to find somebody. And so it was really incredible to find that places like that still exist. And yet even there, I was there with people from Defenders of Wildlife and Center for Biological Diversity tracking the Mexican gray wolf. And it was really kind of eye-opening to see that, yes, the Mexican gray wolves, and there's only 106 of them in the wild, they're some of the most carefully monitored and managed wildlife on the planet. And yet, you know, they're out on the landscape, they're eating elk, they're eating cattle to ranchers' chagrin, but they're not exactly free. You know, they live in this basically giant box controlled by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Arizona Game and Fish Department. And so it was this kind of weird example of, you know, sort of the tensions about wildness and wilderness in the 21st century.
And similarly, the title from the book, why don't you explain where that comes
from? Yeah, a lot of people ask about that. What does that mean, satellites in the high country? That basically comes from kind of the final scene of the book where I shadowed a bunch of young men. They were all basically boys, ages 17 through 21, on an outward bound mountaineering trip in Colorado. And on the last night of the course, the instructors are having this closing ceremony with the boys. And this incredible Rocky Mountain thunderstorm passes through and leaves the night sky, and, you know, perfectly clear, right? And I'm looking at this, essentially what feels like an unblemished firmament. And what do I see but a star on the move, right? A satellite moving its way across the night sky. Not the first time I've seen that in the backcountry, and I'm sure not the last. And so it goes to show that every place on the planet, even the solar system, is marked in some little way by our fingerprints. And yet, as I say in the closing line of the book, Earth remains a perfect mystery. And so it's kind of this tension, or satellites in the high country is this perfect little encapsulation of how, yes, the human fingerprint is everywhere on the planet, and yet our wonder and our awe with wild nature can remain a really powerful force.
With the centennial of the National Park Service, where do you see funding and prioritization for the National Park Service? There hasn't been a new one opened up in far too long.
Yeah, I think the last national park that was created was actually here in California, was Pinnacles National Park in Central California. Yeah, the National Park Centennial comes at a really interesting time. You know, in one way, Americans across the board, left, right, and center, regardless of political affiliation, Americans' passion and commitment to preserving our national parks remains in many ways as strong as ever. And so I think in some ways the centennial is going to be a real celebration. At the same time, the Park Service is confronting new challenges and pressures like it's never seen before. And I think the most obvious one, right, is climate change. For the book, I interviewed John Jarvis, the director of the National Park Service. And Jarvis is a really interesting, thoughtful guy. And we talked about, yeah, what is it going to look like in the 21st century as the parks change before our eyes, right? By the end of this century, there's not going to be any glaciers in Glacier National Park. In a worst-case scenario, Joshua trees moving either northward or upward in elevation might leave Joshua Tree National Park. Sequoias in Sequoia National Park are also facing new stresses. And so, you know, talking with Director Jarvis from the Park Service, he's sharing with me, wow, are we going to have to irrigate the sequoias in Sequoia National Park to keep them alive? And so there's going to be a lot of really tough choices coming down the pike in terms of what do we want to save and to what lengths are we going to go to try to save them. And it's going to make the job of the National Park Service more challenging than ever. That said, I think kind of the answer, right, is not that, yes, we know that these big parks and preserves that we've created in the 20th century, they are essential but insufficient for preserving biodiversity. So they're great, but they're not enough. So that doesn't mean get rid of them. It means actually we need more parks and preserves, and or we need to find some ways to connect the parks and preserves that we already have, to create wildlands corridors through private lands and state lands and agricultural lands and ranches, little ribbons, right, so that flora and fauna and birds can find a way to move as the stresses of climate change become more intense.
Now, you're obviously talking more about true wilderness, but one of the things that I think is a challenge, and I think you'd agree that if we can get more and more people in touch with nature on any level, that our priorities will shift and we'll have more of a focus on preserving these wonders. One of the real head scratchers is that people in a city like San Francisco probably get more time with solitude and nature because of our parks here than many people in suburban places that have not set aside public land for wilderness. And you go 100 miles outside of San Francisco, Everything is posted. You can't just like wander off. There's no trespassing signs. How do we get past that barrier?
Well, I think part of what you're talking about is kind of the tension that's been around for a while between, you know, what we get out of those big remote wilderness areas and the virtue of the nearby nature, right? Our local and municipal parks, our state parks and preserves, or, you know, some private conserves like things held by the Nature Conservancy. And it's really important to remember that most people's most regular, most intimate, and most emotional connection with wild nature is not going to come in the big remote wildernesses. It's going to come in what is called the nearby nature, right? So the local seashore, the local beach, the local forest preserve. And so I think the big challenge facing the conservation movement in the 21st century is kind of how to walk and chew gum, right? How do we at once protect and preserve those large landscapes and recognize that we need the Golden Gate National Recreation Areas, or again, here in the Bay Area, the Don Edwards Wildlife Reserve down in the South Bay. That's essentially, you know, next to Silicon Valley. I mean, it's in the East Bay, but
there's nature all around us. It's just a question of being able to look up and appreciate and also allow for play for humans to kind of appreciate it.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think it's so important to recognize that wildness manages to sneak back in, like the urban coyotes, or the amazing story of the comeback of the mountain lion in the American West, where there are now mountain lions living inside Los Angeles. There was a mountain lion spotted for the first time in San Francisco this summer. I've seen, just hiking through the hills of Berkeley and Oakland, camera traps from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service monitoring mountain lion activity within sight of the UC Berkeley campus, right? So it's so important to know how wildness creeps back in. And yet at the same time, I don't think we want to compare, you know, a raccoon rummaging in your garbage can to a lynx prowling the Northern Rockies. I mean, there's a big difference there. And each have their own virtues. But in both cases, and you kind of mentioned this, the kind of, you know, the tensions around the urban coyotes, all of this gets back to the issues of, are we willing not only to spare some lands, right, the big open wildernesses, but even in the nearby nature, can we share lands with other critters? And that gets really challenging, right? You know, you think about the long-running battles over wolf reintroduction, or again, the issues with mountain lions, where you had a very scary episode, right, of a young boy attacked by a mountain lion in Silicon Valley, I think last year in 2014. So it's not to be taken lightly, but, you know, how are we going to find a way to also share space with other critters? And I think that's going to be one of the real challenges and opportunities of conservation in the 21st century, trying to find in our suburban areas, in our farms and ranch land areas, and even in our cities, how can we share space with other critters?
But I'm talking also about the challenges of connecting rural America with wilderness. People who live in rural areas don't necessarily have the wilderness experience we assume they do.
That's totally right. I mean, I think it's important for city dwellers who are listening to Sea Change Radio to remember that, you know, farms and ranches are not exactly a wild area. Those are human landscapes, right? They're clearly domesticated landscapes. If you drive through the Midwest, you are seeing a giant monocrop of corn, right? Or maybe of soy. If you drive through the Central Valley of California, that's an industrialized landscape. And yes, rural folks, rural communities' access to wild nature in many cases might be, you know, even more restricted or more compromised than a lot of city dwellers. How to address that? Again, I think it's through this mix of protecting those big landscapes, the national parks, and at the same time trying to find ways for those local parks and preserves.
I'm just a wild man. I'm just a real cool cat by Geiger. I'm just a wild man. I had breakfast with a tiger. You better smile, man. You know that I'm wild. I'm just a wild man. I took a caravan and slowed it. I'm just a wild man. I had a million bucks and showed it. I swam the Nile, man. You know that I'm wild.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jason Mark. He's the author of Satellites in the High Country and the editor of Sierra Magazine. So, Jason, I know you're new to Sierra now, but Sierra's challenge is similar to many environmental organizations in trying to pick and choose where to put their energies and efforts in terms of conservation while we have this umbrella kind of looming over everything of climate change. How has that affected big organizations like Sierra Club to try to wend its way through this labyrinth of picking and choosing?
Sure. So I think, you know, listeners probably know the Sierra Club. BEST is a group that's been at the forefront of American conservation for 125 years since we were founded by John Muir. And you think about Yosemite, you think about Kings Canyon National Park, you think about North Cascades National Park. These places wouldn't have existed really without the Sierra Club. And yet, as we've gotten into the 21st century, clearly the biggest threat to those places is not necessarily the bulldozer or the logging company, though those threats do remain. It's global climate change. And so this is why, under the leadership of our executive director, Michael Brune, the organization has made such a huge new push into addressing global climate change. The single biggest campaign now at the Sierra Club is our Beyond Coal campaign, trying to break this country off of our dependence on coal, which is the largest single driver historically of greenhouse gas emissions. You know, I think it's fair to say that some members, some Sierra Club members, when the club started on this work, kind of scratched their heads and kind of thought, well, what does coal have to do with wilderness? What does coal have to do with parks? But, you know, I was just on book tour for Satellites in the High Country, and I met with a lot of members, especially, you know, from Northern California into Oregon and Washington. And I think folks get it now. They understand that there's the 20th century ideal of drawing two-dimensional lines on a map no longer works as well as it once did when the threats are multidimensional, right? Especially climate change. And so it's very clear how carbon pollution impacts not only public health and safety, right? And not only really the future of our civilization, but also impacts the big wild places that we love and care for. And so I think there's a lot of connection in the work. I think going forward, you know, the Sierra Club, obviously a lot of other groups, played a big role in defeating the Keystone XL pipeline. And it's becoming clear that kind of the next order of business, you know, where's the energy going to go after Keystone XL? Well, it's going into the national movement to keep it in the ground, right? To keep fossil fuels in the ground, and especially to keep in the ground the fossil fuels that are on our public lands, right? The insane way that we, the taxpayers, are subsidizing coal mining and oil and gas drilling on public lands. And that Keep in the Ground campaign, I think, is so important because it really is like the Venn diagram. It's the real overlap between that traditional conservation work and the new work of stemming global climate change, saying our public lands should not be essentially mortgaged for pennies on the dollar.
So an organization like Sierra has to just embrace the connectedness of it all.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that right, the original insight of ecology, of the science of ecology, and this comes again from John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club, is that when you try to pull out anything in nature, you find that it's hitched to everything else. And that's just as true of political ecology as it is of biological ecology, that these things are connected. Again, our desire to protect public lands and climate change, and that those things are also connected to other social movements and other social struggles, from everything from, you know, reproductive rights, that's connected very clearly to global population increase in the effort to stem global population, which is a Sierra Club priority, to things like the Black Lives Matter, you know, movement, recognizing that environmental justice and the disproportionate impacts of pollution on communities of color, that's so important as well. So you can't pull out any of these things. And that, I think, is the real again, challenge and opportunity for the Sierra Club and for our members is to see how all these things are connected.
I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you saw it, but former governor of California and movie star Arnold Schwarzenegger just recently posted something on his Facebook feed, which kind of went viral. Did you see this?
The little movie he did, or the Bill Nye thing?
No, it was just a general statement about climate change. I'll send it to you. But in essence, he said, you know, I don't care what you think about climate change, if it's real or not. Does it matter? We have all of these other issues that can be improved by going to a clean energy future. His analogy is, I give you two garage doors to enter, and you have to stay in that garage with that car running for an hour. One is the electric car, one is a gasoline-powered vehicle. Obviously, you're going to take the electric car. That's oversimplifying it, of course, but that's what he's saying. It's like, what is the future? It's not these fossil fuels. And I just think that he was able to kind of distill this and strip away the partisanship and make a very good case whether or not you're a denier or believer, or you want to be anti-science or pro-science. Where do you think we're headed as a planet? Is there any rationale for embracing yesterday's fuels?
Yeah, you know, kind of on that same point, one of my colleagues at the Sierra Club has got a little note up on their cubicle that says, even if you don't believe in the science of global climate change, wouldn't you want to have clean air? I mean, there are tens of thousands of premature deaths that happen every year in this country, mostly due to coal pollution and the soot and particulate matter from burning coal. So, I mean, it's insane that we are essentially still using a 19th century technology, coal and oil, to power the 21st century. Can you imagine if we were still using 19th century phones? I mean, that would be insane.
When you think about coal, somebody stuffing... You wouldn't even put coal in your fireplace, right? But you're actually, millions of Americans are firing up their iPads.
From coal.
That same way.
Yeah. No, it's totally true. And it is an insanity. And we've got to find a way to essentially transition to a 100% clean energy economy. I think the good news is that that's not science fiction. We have the technologies that we need to get there. They are off the shelf and shovel ready. The challenge is a political and cultural one, is actually getting people to recognize and imagine that it's possible, and then knocking down the political barriers that are in our way. And I guess, you know, as Governor Schwarzenegger said, when we do that, we will see all of these other benefits, from an enlivened economy to just a cleaner air and cleaner water. And that alone should be worth it.
Satellite's gone up to the sky. Things like that drive me out of my mind. I watched it for a little while. I love to watch things on TV.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jason Mark. His new book is Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. At one point in the book, you write, quote, "No one under 40 seems to backpack anymore." What'll it mean for the future of land preservation if there isn't a constituency of wildland lovers out there?
This is one of the huge challenges facing the American conservation movement, is how do we ensure that there is a constituency basically of millennials, that are just as passionate about wild lands and wilderness as, say, the baby boomer generation. Because, right, you don't fight to protect what you don't love, and you don't love what you don't know. And so it's frightening, right, the prospect that wilderness will come to seem just a bunch of old dead white guys tromping through landscapes that no longer exist. And so the Sierra Club, along with other big conservation organizations, along also, I have to say, with the National Park Service, under the leadership of Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell, are all working really hard to ensure that we've got a 21st century constituency of wildlands lovers who look like this country, right? That reflect the ethnic diversity and the age diversity of this country. So, you know, I went to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge with a woman named Rue Mapp, who's got a great group called Outdoor Afro, which does what it sounds like. Rue is working with communities around the country to increase African-American participation in outdoor recreation. There's a similar group called Latino Outdoors. Those groups, among so many others, are so important to, again, ensuring that we've got a cohort of wildlands lovers that look like this country. So it's a big challenge, but I have to say, I'm cautiously optimistic that we're rising to meet it.
And you're the founder, I forgot to mention, of the largest urban farm in San Francisco, the Alemany Farm. It would seem like these educational efforts to get lower and middle class kids who don't have a chance to get into the wilderness, urban farming could be a nice kind of interstitial of understanding where your food comes and then going out and seeing how fragile an ecosystem is.
Yeah, so I wasn't the only founder. I'm one of the co-founders of Alemany Farm, which is a 3.5-acre organic fruit and vegetable farm located just about a half mile from the Sea Change Radio studios. And again, I think Alemany Farm is another great example of the nearby nature, that it's essentially for people who've not had a lot of time in wild nature. It's a little bit of a gateway drug. So for the most part, yeah, it's a domesticated space. We're using the land for human needs, right, to grow food. And at the same time, we've got a lot of wildness out there. You know, we've got a perennial stream. We've got a pond that is home to all sorts of birds, red-winged blackbirds, herons, white egrets. In the springtime, a lot of mallard ducks will come through on the Pacific Flyway. It's an incredible place to get this little glimpse into nature. And yeah, I guess my hope would be that someone comes out there, they get that little taste, and then they want to go explore more.
Jason Mark, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's really fun to be back again.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Martin Simpson, Mose Allison, and U2. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.